The Vietnam War, it's over. Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft. Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone. I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction. Today I'm speaking with Janine Atkins, the author of Little Woman in Blue, a novel about May Alcott, the sister of Louisa May Alcott, and the model for Amy, the youngest of the four March girls in Louisa's Little Women. Like Amy, May wants to be a painter. But for you... Hello, everyone. I'm C.P. Leslie, the host of New Books in Historical Fiction. Today I'm speaking with Janine Atkins, the author of Little Woman in Blue, a novel about May Alcott, the sister of Louisa May Alcott, and the model for Amy, the youngest of the four March girls in Louisa's Little Women. Like Amy, May wants to be a painter. But for a young woman of modest means in mid-19th century Concord, Massachusetts, art is at best a doubtful occupation. Even parents known for their unconventional ideas and their devotion to transcendentalist philosophy expect their daughters to put marriage and motherhood, or at least the needs of their natal family, ahead of personal ambition. The conflict between these sets of expectations, especially as they play out in May's relationship with her older sister Louisa, forms the heart of this novel, as we discover right away. Anna, mentioned in the excerpt that follows, is the oldest of the Alcott girls, Meg March in Little Women. May's nightgown brushed her feet as she and her sister climbed the hill behind their house. They clipped enough pine branches to overflow their baskets. When Louisa started to turn back, May grabbed her arm and said, "We need more boughs to hide the cracks in the paint." "No one will be looking at the walls." Louisa stepped away. "Everyone will see the chip paint and peeling wallpaper and pretend not to." "Anna said she wanted to keep her wedding simple." "And you believed her?" May broke another branch, but the sun was rising and there was a lot to do before guests arrived, so she hurried behind Louisa back to the house. They twisted evergreen branches over windows they'd scrubbed with crumpled newspapers and vinegar. Then May brought lilies of the valley upstairs. She twined the cream-colored flowers through Anna's hair. She fastened buttons on the back of her gray poplin gown, wishing her sister had chosen to wear white, like Princess Victoria, instead of stitching a dress she thought was more suitable for a bride who was turning 30. May tossed her a soft, apple-sized bundle and said, "For you." Anna unrolled the silk stockings, which wavered like smoke. "Thank you! Well, what an extravagance for something no one will see!" "You will see them. So will your husband." Anna's face turned pink. May put on her best blue gown and arranged her light hair so it fell in waves between her shoulder blades. She hurried downstairs to help Father carry a table outside. She covered it with a cloth and set out the good green and white china, strategically placing plates over stains. She picked more lilies of the valley and slipped some through a buttonhole of Father's wrinkled linen frock coat. "Mother will like that," May added, in case you forgot, her favorite flower. And now, please join me in welcoming Janine Atkins.
Hi, Janine. Thank you for agreeing to this interview. I'm looking forward to talking with you today.
Thank you. Me too.
So as I always do, I'll ask you to start by telling us something about yourself. You have this wonderful FAQ on your website. I'll give the address at the end of the interview, which mentions that you started writing a diary when you were a child because writing things down in a diary made them seem more real. What did you mean by that?
Well, when you say that, it sounds odd, but I think I still write that way, that I find that when I write things, I find things I didn't know that I knew. And that was the same way as a child, too. I think some were imaginary things, and I think my diary probably, would not be good in a court of law. There was certainly the fantasy element, and, you know, it merged with poetry sometimes, and I didn't care about that kind of lines between fact and fiction. And but I think just having something in words gave me a sense of power over it a little bit.
So how did you get from there to writing fiction?
Well, I guess, yeah, I did mention those blurred lines, but I think also what I loved about fiction is are the scenes, the details of things. I feel like I loved reading because I found out I knew the characters more than people in my own house or neighborhoods, because I got to see their inner life, and that was satisfying to me as a reader and also as a writer. I wanted to explore those inner worlds, but not in a way that was like full of psychological chit-chat, but to have actual people talking together and eating at tables and walking through the woods.
I do think that's one of the really wonderful things about fiction, because we have this illusion that we can know other people, which in real life, of course, we never can.
Yeah. I do know. Just, you know, it's just like the Jane Austen people who, you know, all have a friend in common or many friends in common. So
your site lists 8 current books and 5 on the back burner. Quite a few of them are young adult or children's books, but Little Woman in Blue is for adults, although teenagers will like it as well. What are the differences in writing for child versus adult readers, and does one approach feel more natural to you than the other?
Well, I began writing for adults, then when I had a daughter, I started writing for children, and they all feel the same in that it's, you know, putting words together and trying to find a structure, and So I think it's different topics, really, different subject matters. And I did connect when my daughter was born to the early reading I loved, which included Little Women and Little House on the Prairie books and biographies of strong girls in particular. And so I think that gave me inspiration, as it had as a girl. That was, you know, a focus for what I wanted to do. I wanted to tell stories that I felt I missed as a girl, and that would have helped me as a girl. And that, you know, I try not to be didactic. I try not to be preachy, but there is a certain, you know, element of these are not, not people without flaws, but girls who do have a strong element to them. So that's a source of inspiration, I think. And writing Little Women Blue, moving to the adult world, I just loved May Alcott. And I had written a book for young readers about the Alcotts at Fruitlands when Louisa was 12 and May, as the youngest, was just 3. And I got captured by the youngest sister, who I felt was, you know, rather diminished in the autobiographical Little Woman, you know, that I was reading about other 19th century women artists, and I saw May in that context, and I understood how hard she had to fight to get her work onto walls. So that was an interesting story to me, but her story was not really one for children, in that it wasn't her childhood that was so interesting to me, but how she came to an adult and struggled to have her work shown, but also, unlike Louisa, she wanted to have a family. She wanted romance. She wanted it all, as we sometimes say now.
That's great. So we'll get back to her in just a second, because I really want to go into the details of that.
Okay.
But the books that you have on the back burner, does that mean that you're working on them, or that you think that you might work on them
actually,
someday?
I maybe should rephrase it. I think I showed them as on the back shelf, and basically I was trying to say they're now out of print. So they're books you can find in libraries and sometimes used bookstores that are no longer put forth by the original publisher. So.
Oh, okay. So that was my misreading. Okay, good.
Well,
So you're a busy lady. You teach, you write every day. I see you're starting your own publishing company, Stone Door Press. I won't ask where you find the time, but I will ask you to tell us a bit about She Writes Press, which has published Little Woman in Blue, and what made you decide to start a press of your own?
Well, the press of my own is very little. There's just one book at this point, so I'm not enormously busy there. But the way I liked writing as diaries, a girl, in some ways has moved into writing a blog as an adult. And on my blog, I like to write mostly about things that I struggle with in writing and things that, obsess me as I write. So it's sort of a blog for other writers, and people have told me they've been inspired by it or feel a certain company in watching what I go through. So after some years of doing that, I said, I do feel I have something to say to other writers. So I put together a book called Views from a Window Seat, and that's a collection of writing going through the seasons and taking on the beginning of a book, getting through the tough middle where things like to sag, and then coming to a conclusion that's still perhaps a little bit open. So, I there are a lot of writing books out there, but I thought, well, this is just a simple book I'd like to have when I give workshops or as a teacher I could use. So, I self-published that, and it's just quietly there. So when I came to Little Women in Blue, and what led me to She Writes Press is I had people I knew in the children's book market, but not people I knew in the adult market. And as you mentioned, like, this book is one for teens, and there's certainly a lot of crossover between books for teens and adults, but in the publishing world, those are still separate categories or separate editors. So I had an agent for a while who didn't place it, got good comments. And then I saw another book called Hysterical, which was about Anna Freud, and it was a fictionalized version of her life. And that was by She Writes Press. And I looked it up, and it, described itself as somewhat mission-driven, trying to get women's voices into the world, and hybrid. So all the authors put up money there, but we have the potential of making more money too. And a lot of the work we do ourselves, but it's in support from the publisher and also support from other authors as well, communicating with each other. So I did find, doing Views from the Window Seat, I got help from my husband as a tech person, but a lot of it was me making my own mistakes and making my own little triumphs. But I did like the idea of working on something but having a community to support it too. And that has been the experience with that. So I'm grateful for that.
Well, it does sound very interesting. Speaking of community, I also noticed that you're part of a longstanding critique group, which is my experience too. I mean, I have a wonderful group that I still work with, although ours is a baby compared to yours. So how did you find these people, and how does it, what has kept you together for so long? It's been almost 20 years, right?
I know. No, yeah, I think it's more like 25. It's, you know, I love them so much, and I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, just like our family, we can kind of take them for granted after, you know, years and years, and yet they're so really vital. And we really got together, you know, through a call for novelists looking for each other, and there were more people to begin with, and, you know, over the years, some people left, you know, for various reasons. They were leaving writing or moving or getting distracted by families or work. And the four of us really did stay together. And we did have one point about 7 years in where things got pretty dicey with one member. And we, you know, had to ask her to leave. And after that, we said, it's just going to be the four of us. We're just going to stick together because, you know, this was an awful person, but she just didn't work with the group. And so for the 20 years or so, we've really just stuck with the four of us, even though it's somewhat small. But, you know, I think we do feel, you know, somewhat like family. We've seen, you know, kids grow up over these years, and they all write hard and are excellent critiquers. And again, like, you know, a family knowing your history, they know our history too, of what worked and what didn't work. And so we sometimes get to celebrate together, and we certainly complain a lot together. And, you know, that kind of venting is also sometimes as essential as getting pretty rigorous critiques from each other.
That's great. So let's now talk about Little Women in Blue. And one of the things that surprised me, in preparation, I decided to go back and read Little Women and the sequels because I hadn't read them since I was about 12, probably. And so I couldn't remember all of the details. And so I was really surprised to discover from your book that many of the incidents in that series were Louisa's invention, that because it reads like something that she had experienced herself. Where did you follow? What kinds of sources are available on May's life, and where? How did you discover which parts of it were invention and which parts were made up?
Well, you know, there's always a bit of uncertainty there, but there are lots of biographies. There were lots of letters. Some of the family wrote memoirs. Neighbors, including, you know, the Hawthorns, not only Nathaniel and Sophia, but their children wrote memoirs. They lived next door. So there was, you know, this was such a literary town. You know, we had a lot, you know, to work with. And often with May, it was, her name wasn't missing, but I knew the scene, such as, you know, the famous, you know, I start out with Meg's wedding, which was described in Little Women, and there were echoes in Little Women that were in the diary too. We know what time it was, what they ate, what Meg wore, and those things were replicated. But we know Louisa did have this brilliant imagination. She did not want to write Little Women. She was asked to do it and sort of begrudgingly did because she thought it might make some money, which it did. And but her heart was in Gothic novels, really. I mean, she loved murder and mayhem and all kinds of things that she has Joe write in Little Women, and Mr. Bear tells her, this is not literature. She felt a little bit ashamed of it. But I think she, most, you know, followed a lot of things, but I could explore, you know, what was different from the biographies in Little Women, and then had to ask myself, well, why did she change that, and why did she leave that out? So,
this is a side note, but I was in the library yesterday, and I saw one of her novels, one of the more Gothic ones. I think it's been republished by some publisher. I didn't get it because I have a lot on my plate at the moment with the interviews, but I was really interested. Actually, it's from a modern perspective, at least the parts of it I read, it's a much more modern novel. It's much less moralistic than these novels that she wrote, I guess, for kids. So she put this element in.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. Yeah, it was, she had those two sides because, you know, she published most of those under a pseudonym. She was a little embarrassed, but she had a lot of fun writing them. And I think after Little Women, she did feel that she had gotten a trap, and it was a money trap in some ways. And I think, you know, she even would, you know, say these novels are pretty moralistic, but, you know, the public is eating them up. And she ended up, you know, helping her sister May financially and supporting her parents. And her sister was widowed quite young, and she supported her and her two sons. So she had this big family to support, and went with what was paying.
So what is it for you as a novelist working with these very well-documented historical characters? Did you have to create scenes out of your own invention, or do you follow the historical record as accurately as you can?
I really did try to follow the historical record and invent what wasn't written in some ways. When I wrote Becoming Little Women about the Alcott-Sefrew fruitlands, my editor at the time said, you know, there are librarians and researchers who know every single thing that happened, and we don't want, you know, the spell of disbelief to be broken, or for them to say, you know, well, why did you change this? Why did you change that event? So I really tried to respect everything that was known, and the invention came between what was never said, or what was May doing during that particular time, which, you know, often isn't said, or taking, you know, little bits of scenes and trying to see them through May's perspective. Perhaps, you know, for example, we do know that, you know, time in which Louisa wrote Little Women, and we've seen drafts and know things. And we know May was hearing this and reading it, and she illustrated the first edition. But we don't really know exactly what she thought beyond the fact that she does write that she hated Little Women. And it's understandable why in some ways. I mean, her depiction is not a flattering one. So things like that I could fill in. Well, what did she say to her sister about this book that diminishes her and her art?
So this really brings us, I think, to the heart of, maybe not the heart of the book, but certainly a very important element in the book, which is May's relationship with Louisa. So can you talk about them as individual personalities, at least as they appear in Little Woman in Blue, and then about their relationship, which is, well, like most sisterly relationships, I think, rather mixed.
Well, yeah, I knew, you know, because there's more information about Louise, I came into the book through her. I was reading her biographies, and I had grown up admiring her as well. But I did see, you know, and many people note there was a different Louisa than we see, you know, as Jo March, who, you know, so many of us writers particularly grew up admiring her independence. And, you know, Louisa went to, as a nurse in the Civil War and in her 30s, and came back very sick. And after that, she changed in many ways. She was not as healthy, and she was not as happy, and she was not as you know, independent. I think she felt the burden of the world upon her shoulders. She had gone into this as a great adventure and wanting to do something for abolition and help the nation. But she was ill, and like many ill people, you know, she'd lost some of her spirit, sadly. And so there were the two Louises, I think, that way. And I do. There's a line, I know, when many people read the book, and they say, well, you know, she is rather grumpy, and she is. We see more of the older Louisa, and she's a critical one. I mean, I think also part of her struggle was trying to win her father's admiration and never getting it. So there was a certain bitterness about that too. And with May, I did come in with also admiring her as a young artist, reading Little Women. But as an adult, I realized that she took her art a lot more seriously. Much of her art's hanging in the Orchard House in Concord, Massachusetts, where Louisa ended up writing Little Women. I knew she had shown work in the salon. She made Turner copies, very difficult to replicate his watercolors, which were sold as we now can buy prints or postcards. At the time, people actually bought watercolors done by copyists. So there was a lot more seriousness than I thought she was given credit for. But she still had the light heart. She was the youngest child. She saw some of her sister's struggles, and she didn't try to win her father's love the way Louisa did. I think she kind of saw that's a lost cause, and I'll go out and get my sense of love elsewhere. She loved food and clothing and things that, you know, conquered at the time, you know, were kind of, you know, let's be transcendentalists. Let's, you know, not care about these things. And yet she loved them, and not in an entirely selfish way. I mean, she loved making dinners for people and dressing up for people and making the tables look nice. So different values.
So that actually, this is a question I was going to ask you later, but it fits in really well here. I do get the impression from the book that the parents, both Mrs. Alcott and Mr. Alcott, were less saintly than in Little Women, which they would pretty much have to be if they were going to be real human beings. But can you tell us a little bit? I mean, the idea of Louisa with all of her success, looking for her father's love and not finding it. I mean, there's a certain kind of tragedy there.
There's a real tragedy there, and it was made worse that her father actually died 2 days before she died, and so she never even got to live a life, you know, without wondering about him. But he was an enormously complicated man, and sort of hard for most women to love, although he has his admirers. He did have, you know, great goals for abolition. Theoretically, he was for women's rights, but it didn't really act out that way very much. Louisa talked about a philosopher as being a man in a balloon with, you know, several women needed to, you know, pull him down. And of course, she and her mother were those women often. They were practical. The mother worked very hard to make sure the family was fed, and she had to do that somewhat secretly in those days too, that she came from a well-to-do family and was, everyone expected the husband would support her, but he couldn't hold down a job. He taught, but infuriated people. He just, you know, believed in the lilies of the field all coming to us. So Abigail, the wife, had to be the practical one. And I think she was a little bit resentful about that, which, you know, is certainly very understandable. And in Little Women, we see her struggling with her temper and teaching her daughter to deal with her temper. And when you read the biography, you're like, you should be angry. Throw those pillows. I mean, you know, they came close to starving, and, you know, the father didn't really come to grips with that. So there was reason to be angry. And of course, also the scolding Louisa got, the lessons she got, the father telling her that, you know, having her temper was wrong, having her ambition was wrong. So it is tragic.
I may get some of that too. I mean, they don't really understand her art. They want their highest goal is for her to get married and have kids, which is typical of the time.
So, yeah. And I think that's why I think she saw, like, Louisa, you know, wanting to get that affirmation. And I think she really just said, that's not happening, and, you know, didn't really try for it there. I mean, she, you know, she did enjoy teaching to an extent, because I think her students did adore her, and they would wear her hair long the way she did and wear blue the way she did. So and young men adored her, so she was like, okay, that's fine, you know, I'm not entirely of this family, so You know, there was certainly always affection and ties, but I think she knew the art that mattered so much to her and the physical things of the world that mattered a lot to her were always going to be denigrated.
So you mentioned earlier that May wants two things. She wants to have a family, and that means not only a husband, but a child. And she wants also to be an artist. Probably from the way she's described, she doesn't have illusions that she's going to be a master artist, but she wants to have a career as a painter. So set this up for us at the beginning of the book. We won't go all the way through, but just at the beginning of the book, let us know what she's doing so that she can meet these ambitions.
I'm sorry, I'm not quite sure what the question is. What is she doing to show that?
Yeah, tell us what's happening at the very beginning of the book so that we see what it is that she wants and how she's going about getting it.
Oh, okay. Well, it does, you know, it does start with a wedding that, you know, ends the first half of Little Women, which was originally the first half of the book, that there is a sense of course, novels, the book ends when somebody gets married. And so I wanted to start a book with that. It's like, well, there's a whole new story starting here. And so she's watching the wedding. But again, her older sister was, you know, kind of fit in with family values in terms of, you know, let's have a simple, humble wedding. And May is talking about, you know, Queen Victoria's wedding gown and the kind of, you know, foods they would have there. And when she has a wedding, you know, her mother won't be in the kitchen. So sort of having those fantasies. And, you know, this is when we meet her, and she is still 18 and young and will develop. But I wanted to show her artistic eye and how it came out in setting tables and, you know, finding flowers for her sister's hair and that kind of thing. And feeling a pull towards marriage and a family, but also this other pull where she, like Louisa, would, you know, like her name to be known. She would like to show that the Alcotts weren't just a family who couldn't keep a house together, who couldn't necessarily find food on their table, and was ambitious.
And unlike the rest of them, she's quite upfront about her desire to marry someone well off or to live.
Yes. So, yeah, she's, you know, that was, again, something, you know, that the family, oh, no, you know, this is certainly a theme in Little Women, you know, you must be content with what you have. But she's like, well, why? You know, it's like, I would like nice things. And she got, you know, flack in the family always for that kind of thing. There was a story that was often told in the family of the father going off on lecture tours and coming back with, you know, a single dollar in his pocket after being away for months. And Marmy and her mother says, well, all that matters is that you're home. And May's like, actually, you know, it's not all that matters. And so she's sort of shown as being materialistic, but, you know, we all are materialistic in some ways, and that is a necessity. So,
Well, again, in that sense, I mean, she's probably, I mean, she may have hated Little Women, but when I reread it, I never thought badly of her portrayal as Amy. And when I reread it, I thought that in some ways she was the most realistic of the group. You know, I mean, it's really not a bad portrayal. There are moments when she's set up for being ostentatious or.
Plenty of girls, including me do like her, and partly it is for that realism. I think, you know, the crux of what I see is, as you know, what she found not liking in Little Women was giving up art for marriage. And I think she thought that was not something she ever meant to do. And I feel like she forestalled marriage because she was afraid that in a day when marriage meant having children soon, that she would lose her grip on it. And it mattered that much to her that it hurt to be depicted as having the words in her mouth, you know, if I can't be a genius, I'll be nothing. And I think, you know, I'll give up art. And I think what I feel passionately about and what drove me to May is that all of us deserve to create, to make beauty, to have something. And we're not all going to be the experts at it. We're not all going to be Michelangelo, but it doesn't mean, you know, we should put down the paintbrush or the pen. So.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And in fact, that's what we see in the beginning of the novel is she goes to Boston to teach and eventually teaches painting. How does that happen?
Probably the best way for women to earn money as teachers. And at that time, most public schools and even private schools, education stopped for women about 15 or 16. Very, very few would go on to college. So sometimes teachers like her would teach music, would teach art. And, you know, of course, it was supposed to be more, this is something these women can stay busy with until they get married, and perhaps then teach it to their daughters. So it was somewhat as a nicety for women. And yet there was also, you know, you feel reading about other women who went to these classes, there was a feminist undertone where, oh, actually we're all women working together. And, you know, maybe the world is going to change. Maybe we can work for models one day. Maybe art schools will open to us. Maybe one day we'll have our paintings not just in our homes, but other people's homes, and maybe even museums. So there was a an ambitious undercurrent through it.
At the same time, you can see from May's story how difficult it was for a woman to be an artist. I mean, she's there teaching in Boston. She's making some success. And then she has to go back to Concord to help her mother, and Louisa falls ill, and May is the one who nurses her, and Anna falls ill, and May is the one who looks after the baby. And, you know, I'm assuming that these are real incidents, but it really gives you a sense of even, you know, no matter how, or maybe the better way to put it is it gives you a sense of how committed a woman had to be to keep pushing on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think those resonated with me because those are still issues today. I mean, they were more so than when housekeeping, you know, could be enormous and you had to go out to the well and you had to, you know, wash things on scrub orbs and cook things entirely from scratch. But you do see that in May's biography, and you know, we don't get all the details of the housework and caretaking, but those are somewhat easy to imagine. But we do get a sense of, you can kind of see, well, here she was teaching, you know, in Boston, and now she's back in Concord. And there's definitely a record of, you know, when she goes back to Concord, she is somewhat depressed. It's, you know, she's there to take care of somebody or other who, and that was, you know, again, the single woman's role was taking care of the nieces, the nephews, the parents, the ill sister. So, there was a continual back and forth, and I think that, of course, you know, slowed her progress as an artist, and, you know, often does slow the progress of women. You know, she was a teacher of Daniel Chester French, who at 18 was allowed and encouraged by his parents, you know, certainly enormously talented person, but once he started doing art, he could just do art. You know, somebody else was cooking for him, cleaning for him, you know, taking care of the family. So that was a big difference.
This is the guy who did the Minuteman statue, right?
Yeah. And then the Lincoln Monument. Yeah. So very talented and very wonderful, and dear to my heart also because he always did credit in his memoirs, May, as his first teacher. And if you see his house in the Berkshires, they have a display of the first sculpting tool that May gave to him. So, you know, she saw his talent and encouraged it. And, you know, certainly he did have a gift, but there still is, a sense that, you know, the trajectory of his art was different also just because he was a man, and, you know, the family was encouraging that in a way that they never experienced.
Yes. I mean, I think that's even still true now, as you mentioned before. Mm-hmm. I mean, my husband and I used to say, we need a wife.
Yeah, exactly.
So, but nonetheless, May presses on, no matter how many difficulties are thrown in her way. And eventually she publishes a book, which was news to me, called Concord Sketches. Tell us about the book and about, you know, this is where her somewhat tortured relationship with Louisa again comes into the story.
Yeah, she, you know, she did like going out in the woods, and she sketched bridges in the woods and houses of Emerson, of the Hawthorns next door. She sketched Walden Pond and the bridge where the Minutemen went over. So people were interested in that as a piece of history in some ways, that the, you know, town was recognized as being literary and important. So she did get a publisher to do this as a sort of coffee table book. And this was in the year just after Little Women had been published, and Louisa was asked to write a preface. And again, I knew this from biographies, but when I went to the special collections in Concord Library to see the book, I was horrified to see the preface, because in it, Louisa says, you know, this is the work of an amateur. It's only of interest because of what is depicted, not because of the art itself. And I was astounded that they would even publish that, because how does that help sell a book? And I did have to question Louisa's, you know, jealousy of her sister. Louisa was independent in so many ways, for suffrage and women's rights, and yet when it came to her sister, she couldn't seem to celebrate some of her successes, and in fact, in this case, seemed to almost deliberately stand in her way. So that was, you know, I think that was a real low point for them both.
This is where the cat should meow.
Yeah.
You missed your cue, buddy.
I know. So, yeah.
So, where do you think that jealousy comes from? Was it just because May was the youngest sister? I mean, at this point, she hadn't done anything that Louisa hadn't done and done better in some sense.
Yeah, I think there was always a certain amount of tension in them. And it's also, you know, probably something, you know, women are instructed in some ways to compete against each other and not entirely celebrate each other. I think, though, it's, you know, she had a hard time seeing that May was grown up. May was 8 years younger than her, and Louisa went home to work, left home to work at 16. And so May was always the baby, and I think May saw her as coddled. It was hard for her to see her for a long time, that she was no longer eight, and that, you know, the coddling was relative. You know, the sisters did look after May, and the sisters did dote on her. And in some ways, you know, being the youngest, the family didn't have the extremes of poverty, because by the time May was growing up, Mrs. Alcott had decided, you know, she was going to work and support the family, and that was that. So things were not as dire then, I think, when they were leaning too much on Bronson, who wasn't capable of doing that. So I think somehow, and I think she resented the fact, you know, that May did have that free spirit too, which sometimes a youngest child can have, of not entitled, but feeling maybe a little entitled, or maybe, you know, feeling she didn't have the moral burdens that Louisa put on herself, the sense that she was never going to be good enough. May liked how she looked. She liked who she was. She liked what she liked. And Louisa really struggled with joy in some ways. It was very hard for her to accept happiness in a certain way. I think she, she probably, you know, had some depression and, which, you know, of course was never really diagnosed. And, so I think kept that, you know, a little bit of resentment, you know, she would talk about things always come easy to me. And, you know, in some ways, you know, Joy did, but May, of course, struggled. And Louisa took her a very long time to recognize, like what you've said, that this is a woman who worked to stay at her art. You know, Louisa seemed to see it as something that was easy for her.
So one character whom I was glad to see, a bit surprised to discover that he had a real life counterpart, and speaking of people to whom life came easy, at least in Little Women, is Laurie, who was in real life the son of Nathaniel Hawthorne, who lived next door.
Yeah, Laurie, you know, one of the things that keeps Alcott, you know, I was going to say fanatics, but I should say scholars, I guess, and fans, you know, going is who was Laurie. And he was probably a composite. There's a certain, Mrs. Alcott took in boarders at a certain point. So there were young boys sometimes living with them that was perhaps a model. And Louisa did have a romance when she was in Europe with a Polish revolutionary who's, again, sometimes considered a model. And also Julian Hawthorne, who lives next door. And the Hawthornes were, you know, it's not the grand house that we see in Little Women next door. There's not the astonishing wealth, but compared to what the Alcotts had, they did think they were wealthy, partly because the Hawthornes had been in Europe, where Nathaniel Hawthorne worked as a consulate in England for years and then went to France and Italy. And so they brought back some marble for their fireplace. And Mrs. Hawthorne was an artist, so she had, you know, sketched scenes in Italy. So people in those days were, you know, looked to Europe for art, more or less, that they didn't see it as coming from America so much. So there was a sense of us and them that I think Louisa did show in those two houses, the Lawrence house next door and the smaller March house.
So what would you like readers to take away from Little Women in Blue? Are there things that I haven't mentioned even that might be important elements of the story?
Oh, I think you've mentioned a lot, and I thank you for that. No, I think it is, you know, I still, you know, I spent years and years writing this book, and yet I still adore May. And I think it is so much of that sense that, you know, whatever our dreams are, that it's good to hold on to them and to honor them and not let other people convince us that they're impossible.
So you write poetry as well as fiction, I understand. How do you decide which form to use in a given setting?
I have recently been writing more poetry, and I really love just honing things down. And I am a writer who, you know, writes 10 pages and ends up with a sentence or that kind of thing. So poetry is good for that. But for Little Women in Blue, I knew it would be about the two sisters and intention with each other, helping move forward, then partly setting them back. And there was a lot of room for dialogue in that, and it would take place over many years. So I felt it had the shape of a historic novel. Other times, my last book, which is Borrowed Names, and it's poems of Laura Ingalls Wilder, Madame C.J. Walker, Marie Curie, and their daughters. So I had three women and three daughters, and poems were a good way to take motifs from their lives to show what they had in common. All these mothers were born in 1868, but from different places and ending up in different careers and different personalities. So the poetry I could, you know, without drawing, like, oh, this is how they're different, this is how they're the same, I could just pick up themes and let them echo within each other. So I don't know. I think as I get older, I like the shorter forms.
It's really interesting. What are you working on now?
I do have a book again for young readers coming out next year called Finding Wonders, Three Girls Who Changed Science. And that's Again, there's three different girls who at 13 found their vocations, and the themes within them sort of echo each other. So
sounds great. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us. It's been a great pleasure.
Thank you so much for your interest.
And thank you for listening to our podcast. Once again, I'm C.P. Leslie, and today I've been talking with Janine Atkins, author of Little Woman in Blue, a novel of May Alcott. You can find out more about her at www.janineatkins.com. That's one word, J-E-A-N-N-I-N-E-A-T-K-I-N-S. Like us on Facebook, search for New Books in Historical Fiction, and follow us on Twitter at New Books Histfic. If you do, you'll see each time we post a new interview. You can find out more about me and my books at www.cplesley.com, which includes my social media links and connects to my blog. There I upload expanded posts about the interviews and in general discuss history, historical fiction, and the rapidly changing publishing industry. Goodbye for now, and check back soon for my next conversation about new books in historical fiction.